Mr. Emery, Rio 7. You were telling a story of this reconnaissance in the Jeep with the colonel and two others.
Yeah. So we get down, as I say, out comes this French woman comes rushing out, slings her arms around me, kisses me on both cheeks and says, "Mom, brave, that's all I know. That's the only thing I understood." And then she rattled off in French. And the MO said to me, "You're too young for that, Emery." Whatever she was suggesting, I don't know. But several other French people come out then, and they'd been in there. It was, we'd done quite a fair bit of damage, what I could see, with the ruin. The houses were ruined. There was slates off and holes in the roof and whatnot else. It was only a two-pounder shell, the Beaufort shell, but you had a HE incendiary and all things like that. And while I'm stuck there then with the Bren gun on this wall, looking out, see nothing coming. And they came out with two French children that had been wounded, I suppose, with our shelling, I don't know, about 8 and 10, brother and sister. So the MO looked at them, one was wounded in the arm, I think one was wounded, so we patched them both up. And it was decided that they take them back to the field dressing station and beyond in the British lines there. Well, I don't know where you know, but a lot of the Jeeps, it used to have a piece of angle iron welded on the front. So if they said the Germans used to stretch cable across the room, you know, chop your heads off if the windscreen was down. So the angle iron was there to break the cable. That was fair comments. But when it come to the CO in the driver in front, the MO at the back with the two wounded children, there was no room for me to get in the Jeep. And so the colonel said to me, "There's only one thing for you, Emery. You have to sit on the bonnet, one leg either side of the..." Sat there with a piece of angle iron and said, "No, I had my rifle." "Oh, no, look, a bit of John Wayne stuff, you know, trying to fire like this a bit." So anyway, you sat on the front. So I sat on the front there, and we started to drive back down through the little hamlet, round the little kink, and down the main road. As we got on the main road, right down the bottom there, I could see in the distance was the infantry units coming up. One section that side of the road, one section the other, as they used to when advancing. And as soon as he seen this Jeep bound towards them from no man's land, they went down in the ditches, and all I could see, I was getting closer, was rifles and Bren gun. I thought, for Christ's sake, don't start shooting now, you know. I was sat on the front of the Jeep there, I was hoping that somebody wasn't going to get trigger happy. And anyway, when we got down there, he was arguing at me, saying, "Look at that city force out there all the..." I thought, well, imagine what the infantry blokes was thinking. But so we came back, and they took them to the field hospital, and they were made a fuss out there and patched up and well looked after. So apart from that, I used to go out line laying, all sorts of jobs I did there, out with the colonel, and he knew everybody. It's funny, you know, these regular officers, "Hello, Hugh," "Hello, Robin," his name was Robin, his Christian, "Hello, Robin, how are you?" And all this sort of 25-pounder units, and used to get round. And so it came to, as I say, line laying, you're crossing the main crossing roads, always tanks up and down, you know, that then cable used to get chewed up, so you daren't cross the main road. You used to climb up the concrete posts, the sort of telegraph poles, I suppose it was. I was pretty nifty at that. I was to put the cable between the teeth and climb up there and get up, so I'm wrap one arm round and sort of tie it round, and then they go across it on a tree and tie it that side. So we had the height. I always remember one day, there was quite a lot of traffic up and down the road, the infantry and other units moving, ambulance as well. And I'm up the tree, and a perishing enemy fighter come over, strafing. I thought, Christ, I'm about 20 feet up in the air. Anyway, nowhere near me, but so I thought, I didn't find out, couldn't have jumped down and broke my neck when I got down. But anyway, that's how we used to cross the roads and things like that. So we came, and it was getting up then. Theory Harcourt was the next place.
Where?
Theory Harcourt. That was on the River Orne. They had to get a bridge out across. They had to get guns across it to cover the Bailey Bridge that the engineers were building. You're not a cat lover, are you? No, that's all right then. Well, anyway, the colonel was out reconnoitring. I was with him. The MO again, Harry and me, out reconnoitring. So we get to this. It was quite, to go down to the Orne, it's quite a steep bank down and up the other side, you know. And Theory Harcourt's a bit to the right down there, but yeah, they were crossing, they were doing the Bailey Bridge on the bottom. So So he gets reconnoitering around this farm and crawling around. It was on fire. Everything, I don't know where we saw on fire, shouting at the Germans, but it was on fire, a lot of wood smoking. We're crawling along so we shouldn't be observed. And I heard this little meow, meow, meow. There was a little kitten there. Whoa, it was about that big. I thought, oh, poor thing, what I'll do, I'll take it back. And when the cooks bring our food up in Ogden, say, you take it back and look after it. So I had my khaki shirt on, no collar, and I picked the cat and stuck it inside my shirt. Anyway, we crawled all around. It wasn't suitable for the colonel. He said, no, this is no good here. So you get back of the Jeep and drive off, going along the road, and I looked down inside my shirt, and that kitten was swarming with fleas, thousands in thousands, all crawling over my chest. So, cruel, really. We got so far along the road, and I'd come to this French house there, and I put me on and slung the thing over the hedge in their garden. I thought, yeah, but it was thousands of fleas on it. So we went from there, and then we decided to go down here. He did, not me. He decided to go down to see where the baby bridge was. So we're going meandering down this lane, and as I said to you about jeeps, past his jeep, it was upside down, burnt out, had gone over a mine, turned completely upside down. And we get right there, I could hear the small arms, Bren guns, and all sorts, spandos going all down. I pity the poor engineers that was trying to build the bridge down there. And gets down in, infantryman dodging out the side of the hedge. I always remember, yeah, Wiltshire on there, Wiltshire Regiment, or Wilts. Said, no further in this here, any traffic further in this here, it's under. So we had to back all the way up the lane then. But anyway, they found what they wanted, so it was supposed to have gone across the other side and occupied them, but they hadn't taken the territory over there for the guns on the other side of the river, but eventually they did. And time went, you know, day in and day out, you come back.
What would a typical day be like, you know, for you during that time?
Well, busy. Sometimes I'd be out and you come back, I'd say come back late at night with the colonel, but you always find that your slit trench for sleeping it was dug. One of your pals and make sure it was... Another little incident was mail. We had a lot of London chats with us, and you know, the V1s were dropping over there, and we moved about quite a lot. It was quite... We attached to this and helped them out and went somewhere else and attached to 12th Corps and 3rd Div and 15th Scottish and all that. Different. So we moved, and mail was... We haven't had any mail for about 3 days. So we moved to this particular site, RHQ. And they said, Embry, go back to the field post office and pick the mail up. They give me it's down so and so, you know where it was, you pass on. Well, anyway, away I went with the mail. The chap was in charge, and Smokey Joe, because he always had a cigarette in his mouth, smoked right, and off we went with the 1500 white truck. Out of the camp, turn right, down the lane. Round the crashed Messerschmitt, it was on the side of the road there, round there, further up to the main road, past the dead cow with his leg stuck up in the air for rigor mortis, turned left and down, got down to where the field post office was, and they moved about 10 miles somewhere else, so I had to go and find it then. So eventually finds it and picks up about 3 bags of mail for 112. And coming back, it was getting dusk then. I've been gone about 2 hours, I should imagine. They were getting worried in back there. I thought I'd take the wrong turning, and same as Vicky Sawyer had done. They come out, so I'm driving back down there, looking for this dead cow, which I knew I had to turn right down the lane there. And going the other way, two military policemen on motorbikes, and this Jeep with the Brigadier's flag. Flying the other way, so Brigadier, where's he going then? I got about another half a mile up the road, and these two Donars or military police pulls up, made me stop. Said, because we had 12th Corps, the Three Trees sign on the truck. He said, the Brigadier's looking for 12th Corps. I thought, well, Christ, that's Andrews. The Brigadier don't know where 12th Corps is. He said, well, I know roughly where they are, because they were about a mile down the road from where we were. So anyway, they went back and fetched the Brigadier, and I took the Brigadier and the two. He followed me down to the dead cow and passed round the mission. I said, straight down the road, sir. And he went on down there. I thought, well, speaks when the common soldier knows more. Yeah.
What else do you remember from that time?
Well, then there was the police gap there, out with the CO there, around. I all remember there, two things I remember there. As I say, it was different from me. I wasn't a gunner, so I wasn't involved in, as you say, the killing side then, put it that way. So I seen the war from a different sort of life to what they did, if you will. Anyway, we went down the corner while we were there, but there was this stone wall there, and it was open territory then, and it was an infantry section here, and a padre. And they had across this open bit of ground, about 50 or 60 yards, and as each one come up to the gap, up and down, carrying his rifle, small packs, the padre would pat him on the back, and he'd go like clappers across his 50 yards, and the next one, like, and I thought, well, you know, what have I got to complain about, really, see? But anyway, that's the first thing I remember. And the second thing, after the battle was over, in the police, seeing to be believed, really. You had to see it, you know, the carnage there, really.
Well, what do you mean? Can you just explain it a bit?
Dead horses, dead blokes lying in the ditches, trucks that was burnt out, blown upside down, everything like from the typhoon rocket fire and aircraft, I suppose. But there was a German medical orderly there. I took a paybook off of him, actually, because he was around picking up paybooks. And they were around collecting in what wounded it was about, if I could see of him. But he had a big red cross on his arm, so I said, I'll have one of them. I still got the paper, but no, it's a sergeant major, German sergeant major. And he said, Adolf Hitler, in good English, better English than I speak, Adolf Hitler, we're not fearless yet, he said. That's what he said to me. And I thought, well, he just had this hammer in there, but he was still confident that Hitler wouldn't let him down. Yeah, and that was, I always remember him, yeah, Adolf Hitler, we're not fearless yet, he said. I said, you think so? I never got involved in any arguing with him, but that was it, yeah. And that's, apart from that, then after that, the chase went on then, up through Belgium, and 112 was taking out the line then, because they couldn't accommodate everybody going out the road. So one battery, I think, I don't know, it was 364, went with armoured cars and things like in the chase, and other parts of the regiment was used driving trucks, bringing up petrol from the on that bit. The guns were stored in or put in the harbour, for want of a better. And another thing, I got sent on this detachment. Then with one officer and about four men, me a signaler. What we were doing, I don't know what the officer, but we had two trucks, him and a 1500 weight in a Jeep. And we went all the way up through Belgium, up as far as Eindhoven, up through Lille. Now, it's mostly compo boxes with the rations, 40 men's rations for one day in there. Used to be everything in there. A, B, C, D, and E was the thing. You got different varieties of each, but they all had 100 cigarettes in, 7 cigarettes per man for one day, and also boiled sweets. Anyway, we got up to Lille. We had these, I used to swap my cigarettes for sweets because I didn't smoke, so then it was my 7, so I used to have their 5 sweets or whatever it was before. We got up to Lille and stopped, and straight away, children, whatever nationality, inquisitive, wherever, and as soon as we stopped for a brew up, they were there. So I got the sweet, I bought about 20 sweets, so I got them out and I was handing them out like this. Anyway, one of these children snatched out, because there was more children than there was sweets, and scratched me on the knuckle. There, only a little scratch like that. I never took any notice of it, you know. I had all my TAB, TT, typhus, and my other vaccinations. Never took any notice of it. No chance of washing it anyway. Now, anyway, it turned septic. Now, and there was no MOs about them, because it was a fluid sort of, and my hand come, oh, terrible. All up my arm, red arm, lying on, and I had my hand band. I was still on this doings, and eventually, they got me. I was really bad with it. They got me a Canadian MO, some Canadian unit, which was on the left of the British, and he gave me some, lanced it, and all that, and bathed it, and treated and gave me this ointment and eventually cleared up. But I had a terrible hand. I only threw that little scratch off that kidney. But he got up as far as Eindhoven in the end. I found the Belgian people very, every time you stopped in these little villages, you had to stop sometime. And as soon as you stopped, they'd all come out with soup. I never drank so much soup in all my life. You know, there were three or four families buying. There was only four men and an officer, but they'd come out with bowls and bowls of soup. Right? You didn't like to be, unsociable then, you know. But everybody, very, very well, I suppose, they were quite happy. Yeah, went through, drove straight through Brussels and out the other side now, and finished up at Eindhoven.
Eindhoven.
I remember it stopped there at an ex-German ACAC site. With the,
but the whole unit concentrated?
No, that's only us five there. A lot of them were still... There was one battery with the armoured cars. The other two batteries were doing any job back in France, doing any jobs, petrol, driving petrol trucks to bring up the trucks to keep the emphasis on the surge forward sort of business. You couldn't get them all on the narrow roads there was. But it was only us five. I don't know what we were there. I never had a clue. From the day I left to the day I got back here, I don't know what we did. He must have known, because he used to go off in the Jeep somewhere and see this and that. But what it was, I don't know. Anyway, we got as far as Eindhoven there, and I always remember that, the Dutch television people, they had their factory there, a great big factory. It went knocked down, I could see, but...
Philips,
that's right, yeah. And... we went and looked at this ex-ACAC site. It was a raised command post. It had everything marked on the top of that ACAC post, distances in kilometres or metres, you know. It showed the church, 2,000 metres and all that. And you could go right round there, and then they had everything sized down to distances there. Then we came back and joined the unit, and the unit then moved up. The Arnhem Doel was over, and they were sort of retreating. We moved up to Grave then. Which was on the Well, I think, River Well, guarding one of the bridges there. It was the Well, and there was a bridge at Eindhoven. That's the last one they took. They didn't get as far as Arnhem, but they had the bridge at Eindhoven. They had the bridge at Nijmegen, I should say, and they had the bridge at Grave, which was before that. It was after. But we were there guarding those bridges there, that bridge there with the ACAC site, and we slept in the field by the side of the river there. That was where I said to you the cook that got the billet from my mother and sister, who gave me the in Southborough. I said earlier on, he had his arm blown off there by a butterfly. He'd come over and drop butterfly bombs, and he lost one of his arms there. Yeah. So then we moved on into Nijmegen then, and was guarding the whole regiment then was guarding the Nijmegen Bridge. The railway bridge had been blown down, so it was only the road bridge left. And the job there was Kronenberger Park. There was a tower there, a stone tower. They all said it was Charmaine's Tower, but it was about 50 foot high, I suppose. But on the top, there was a room at the top, and we had a wireless set up there, RHQ, and I used to do a week up there. Slept up there, lived up there, slept during the day, worked all night, charged our batteries up with a little, all on this top floor. It was a bit of a bawdy thing at times, if I thought I was right. I slept up there with two wireless operators, and at night we used to tune all the radio stations in from the gun sites, and the officer used to come up in the evening, take charge, then if there's any enemy planes over the radio, we'd say all guns fired, and they'd open up a barrage, a box barrage, to safeguard the bridge, you see. But he used to come up at night and go back in the morning. And we used to sleep during the day, and he used to bring our rations up at night when he came up with the officer. And then next morning we'd come in, he used to bring up our other rations. It was bad reception there at night. Oh, it was terrible. You know, you get more atmospherish. You go, hello, Nan Lovey, what's 6, reporter? Nan Lovey, and some you couldn't get at all. So anyway, this particular night, we had a big 208 set there, like a big radio receiver. And that was tuned into the radar or whatever it was that the Yanks were running. And that was switched on at night. And over this radio would come 16 hostile aircraft taken off. And we had a big map there, was fixed up with like numbers along the top, 1 to 10, and down the sides, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Superimposed over a map of the area. And then they used to say 16 hostile aircraft taken off, 6 A6 or something, moving north. So the officer would watch that then. When they said he was moving, turning east or west or towards us, east, I suppose, was it, or west, I can't remember. As it got nearer the bridge, you could plot the air gun. They used to, on this chart, you see, and then when they got nearer, you used to say, all guns fire. But this particular day, this officer came up, and he said, you tuned in, Emery? I said, well, all except you can't get to whatever station it was. He said, well, keep on trying. I said, well, I keep trying, and I can't get him. He said, keep on sending. I said, we're not supposed to send more than 12 seconds at a time, because they get the direction DF's on you. The Germans can pick up your radio signals in. He said, I'm ordering you, don't argue, don't disobey, or you're in trouble, all right? He said, keep, so anyway, I did as I told. And within 25 seconds of him saying that, there was a hell of a bang outside, the 88 millimeter, right outside, blew all the shutters open, and you could hear, and it was a nose cap of the shell rattling around the inside walls. When we shut the trestles back up, no, luckily nobody was killed with the thing, but He changed his mind after that. I proved my point. I said, I get it, and he did. And I picked that nose cap up and burnt my perishing fingers on it. It was still red hot, you know. But several times like that, as I say, in with the mind detect in, if I thought I was right, I said I was right, irrespective of they were. So we moved from there then, eventually. They had several casualties there. I mostly wounded with the shelling. I felt sorry for the civilians there because.
What was the shelling like?
Well, it was mostly long distance. And a few. That's the first time I saw enemy jets as well. They used to come zooming over. It was a bit of an insight that was, because I'd never seen a jet before. They made a heck of a row as well, as opposed to a fighter, an ordinary piston driven fighter. Like, we used to see them too. The ones with the two engine, the 262s, I think it was, they weren't half moving. But they used to come over and drop one or two bombs, but the shelling, it was mostly at night. Sometimes during the day, you go drive up the road in the Jeep, and there'd be three or four bodies covered up with white sheets lying in the road, you know, civilians. But at night, they used to be the lot of big guns. You'd be howling over. We had a chat with us, Derek, his name was. Come from Liverpool, and he used to lay there. They're here again, and bang, they go off the shells. And he kept on. They used to say, "Windy so and so," and all business like that. They all felt the same actually. But anyway, eventually the MO saw him, and he got posted. He was suffering. He'd been buried alive in Liverpool during the blitzes for two or three days, and this had affected him, but nobody knew that at the time, but that's...
So he got shell shock or whatever.
Yeah, well, a bit of a shame, and he got posted when he went back to England, I think. We never saw him again, but... So we moved from there eventually, about December, I suppose, to over towards Roermond in Venlo, over that area on East Holland. RHQ was it, what was it called? I can't think now anyway. Anyways, we were over there and we spent Christmas there. And they put on a party. I was on duty Christmas Eve with the infantry in this derelict house with a radio set, and the infantry were upstairs. I burnt the bottom out of my boots there. It was that cold, I couldn't film the thing. I had a little number two cooker there. Little Petra thing, and I was sat there just with a candle and the radio set on there in this back room, and trying to warm my feet up. They were dead from the ankles down, every feet, and all of a sudden a foot was on fire, and I ripped my gaiter off and took my boot off anyway. Oh, my terrible, my foot anyway. But 2 days later, my boot cracked in half, and I went a big crack right across there. I went to the stores, and the quartermaster, Captain Gore, was going to make me pay for them. But anyway, I got another pair of boots. But they gave the children there in Weert, is the name of the place, little Christmas party we all put our...
Weird.
Weird. W-E-R-T. That was a Dutch town there.
That's in the Venlo area, so...
Yeah, around about there, yeah. All
kind it's all Roman Venlo area, though.
Yeah, all around there. That was... But our HQ was it Weird there, yeah. But we get, as I say, all... chocolate. We used to get one bar, I think... a week or something in sweets, and also they put all that in, give all the kids a bit of a Christmas party there, which is nice.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I wasn't involved in that because I was on duty. We did get billeted in right by the side of the canal. It was cold, as I say, winter in Holland, and they let us, there was about six or eight of us, slept in this room up over the cafe. And in that cafe, they had a Wurlitzer organ. You put money in it, a play. And you know the tune, Hear My Song, Violetta? I don't know what the classical name is, but that was the tune. And that played on. Oh, Christ, I was sick of the sound of that. You'd be lying in bed out there trying to, somebody would come in and put, what, I was 10 cents in the bathing, a pipe out, and it was banging away upstairs. Yeah, I always remember that tune. Every time I hear it, it reminds me of Weird. But I slept in other houses where they sort of got you in all out of the cold. We were stationed somewhere around that area in a farmhouse. And used to, all the petrol and that used to come up in 4 gallon square tins. You know, jerry cans was a boom as far as, but all ours was in square tins. And once it was empty, we used to cut a tin in half and make a wash basin out of it, you know, with a knife. And it was the bath in, heat, drop of petrol in the ground in this Dutch farm in the barn there, freezing cold. And I used to have a wash from the waist upwards and then put the shirt on and wash from the waist downwards in this half a tin of warm water that I, and that was our hygiene, really.
How long were you at Weird, or anything else happened at Weird?
Well, no, it's a few jet fighters were over there, you know, and it was round about then when the Ardennes business started, wasn't it? That caused a bit of a flap on, but we never seen anything of it, not so. There's all sorts going on, and he's seen armoured cars and whatever, panic and anything, I think, like, but nothing happened there, as I say. We were there, then we went down. It was somewhere about there that RHQ got bombed. Oh, that was another thing. We moved into a little hamlet. As I say, it used to be a tactical headquarters and then a rear echelon. The cooks in the, as I say, all the clerks and that used to stay back, and they used to take the ones that were actively involved in it. So we moved into this little, I don't know, it was a little hamlet, and there was a couple of houses there, and we were going to sleep there that night. It was a sort of a big room at the back, and over that side there was a big sort of a Dutch barn with doors on, where the cook was going to make. So anyway, we started just unloading a kit out of the Jeep, and all of a sudden I heard this jet coming over, and he went over, and he actually went like that, without over a lie, he was that low, he went like that, the pilot, see,
waved,
yeah, and was gone. Never had chat. You wouldn't tell me you got the Bren gun out. You're about 4 miles down the road, sort of business. They never took any more notice of that. He was gone. And all of a sudden, he was back again. He turned around, and I'm looking at him. He appeared out the distance, and I could see these two bombs. He released them, and they're both heading towards me, coming straight down. And I'm watching them, and it's like dove flat on the floor by the side of the Jeep. One falls the other side of the houses, and one falls by the barn. Blew the door off on this Fred Budd, the Don R. So we, but out of the house opposite came this woman. Oh, she was a big, big woman, she was. She'd come out screaming her head off, rushing through her and being fainted in my arms. I couldn't pick her up. Oh, Christ, she was heavy. So I had my arms, her back to me, and I had my arms on her, and I had to drag her back across the road and back at the doors and lay her on the floor. Left her there, she started to come round then. And went round to see where Fred was, and Fred was partly buried under this. So I expect to see him squashed to pieces, but he's buried under this.